Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For writer Leslie Marmon Silko, reconnecting with nature is not a quick fix, a glance out the window. It's a way of life learned at the side of Laguna Pueblo Native American matriarchs. At 63, she's looking back on what she learned, and she's living it. Hours watching bees, clouds, a rattlesnake, methodical cataloging of turquoise found on long walks in the Arizona desert, listening to the rocks, trees, animals, spirits. This hour on Point, Leslie Marmon Silko on the sacred bonds of family and nature. You can join the conversation. Do you take the time to really know nature? Can we take the time? And what if we don't? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Portland, Oregon, is Leslie Marmon Silko. Part Cherokee, she grew up on the outskirts of the Laguna Pueblo Reservation in New Mexico. Her first novel, Ceremony, came out in 1977, 78. It sold over 1 million copies. Sherman Alexie calls it the greatest novel in Native American literature. She's author of Almanac of the Dead and Gardens in the Dunes. Her new book, part memoir, part creative rumination, is The Turquoise Ledge. Leslie Marmon Silko, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Well, thank you for having me, Tom.
Take us back to the women you talk about in this book. This is memoir, but it's not just your life that's involved here. There are very important women early in your life who sort of pointed you in the direction that you're writing so much about now.
Well, yes, there was Aunt Alice. Actually, she was my father's aunt. And when I was a little girl, I would hang around her and follow her around in her yard, and she would just sort of follow along with her gardening and so forth. But she used to make little comments and kind of explain what she was doing, and I kind of got hooked on listening to adults while the other kids were off playing.
So, and where was this? What was the setting? And what was the cultural setting, Leslie?
Well, the cultural setting was the Marmon family. Aunt Alice was, part of the Marmon family. And we lived kind of on the edge of Laguna Pueblo. And besides Cherokee, I am Laguna, too, and Mexican. But anyway, the Marmon family was kind of on the edge. My great-grandfather and his brother had come out from Ohio in the 1880s. And so it was a mixed cultural, mixed background that I grew up in. And that's also the one that Aunt Alice had grown up in. And then my great-grandmother, of course, taught me a lot. And she, of course, was full-blood Laguna.
How did you decide over time where your identity would rest? You had, lots of different strands, like a lot of Americans. Yours leans heavily toward Native American, but there's European there as well, and Mexican, as you say. How did you decide where you would stand?
Well, I don't think it wasn't really a conscious decision, but as I, when I was 18 or 19, I realized that the bulk of my attention, most of my life, and most important, what I loved the most was there on the Laguna Pueblo Reservation. It was the people, the land, the animals, and that's where my heart is, and that's where I come from. So I realized that that's where my identity was fixed.
I kind of hate to raise this on a talk show, but I can't help it because it informs your whole book. I mean, you've said that you're kind of tired of talking with human beings. You're kind of tired of human beings, that the rest of what's going on is getting your attention. Now, that's very clear in the book.
Well, Tom, I live in Arizona, and the upheaval that's been taking place for quite a while there it's gone from dialogue to debate to just rancorous shrieking from all different sides. And so,
you're talking about immigration and your governor, Jan Brewer,
and our governor,
laws, and
exactly, and slashing the budgets for state parks, privatizing state parks and letting hundreds of teachers go. And it just finally got to the point where I decided that I couldn't write a memoir that mentioned all of that. So I thought maybe other people are tired of this too. And so I decided that I would focus on the beings and that give me the most pleasure, which are the creatures of the natural world.
And your chapters kind of tell us where you're headed. Ancestors, rattlesnakes, star beings, we'll talk about that. And turquoise, we'll get to turquoise. That's real important here, but we talked a little about ancestors. I hope we do more. But, you know, so when you're trying not to have the chatter of the news in your ear, you know, describe how are you spending your time? What do you find when you go there? What's the realm you get into?
Well, it's very interesting. When I first start out on a walk, my head is still buzzing with all of the different, whether it's from my life or all of the different issues that are going on. But gradually, just your feet having to pay attention to the trail, you begin to focus more just on the immediate moment and instant. And then the desert is so very beautiful. It just folds around you and the sounds and sensations of the air or wind. And pretty soon you'll notice little birds or sometimes there's deer. And it just takes you away and reminds me that at the very bottom we're just all part of nature and we're part of this beauty. And the only ugliness that I can see lately is in the human dialogue.
And that's just for starters. I mean, when it comes to observation and that love of nature, you've been compared to John Muir and much more, but you really get out there. You're feeling things. I don't know if everybody feels. Maybe they just don't take the time. You write in The Turquoise Ledge, if gravity is distributed in this universe unevenly, maybe you're a better physicist than I am, Leslie, I don't know, but then there are places here on Earth where the gravity is weaker or stronger, where even light may speed up or slow down. Take us out on those subtle edges of perception where you're feeling that.
Well, yes, I only have a layperson's understanding, probably very simple understanding of particle physics. But truly, if you walk the same trail, sometime at different times of the day, and you really pay attention, you can see the tricks that light plays and the way that all of our reality, in a sense, at least that we get through our visually, depends on the behavior of light. And there are magical things that happen. Probably scientists there might explain it with humidity or wind or something. But truly, things change the way they look, even though they don't move. Rocks and, sides of mountains and there's these wonderful little shimmerings and glints that I can't really explain, but they're alive.
And you're not just perceiving those in this book, those edges of nature. You're communing in a way here. Just for example, share your rattlesnake story with us. Just off the top of your head, it's a great story.
Oh, the story about freeing the rattlesnake.
Yeah, what happened there?
That one. Well, just early one morning, I heard my dogs barking, and right before dawn, and I went outside, and there was a big rattlesnake, about 4 feet long, quite large around, and it was entangled in bird netting.
Diamondback.
And diamondback, a big western diamondback. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I called the dogs off, the diamondback quit rattling, and he didn't seem to mind that I came close. I wanted to see how badly he was entangled.
Yeah.
And I knew that the bright sun that was coming, the sun was rising, this was in July, that the heat would quickly kill him within an hour or two, so that I had to do something to free him. I felt responsible because I was the one that threw the piece of bird netting out in the yard.
And what did you learn from that interaction? I mean, as you write it, you're writing it as though you and the rattlesnake are communicating at some level.
Well, it must have been that, Tom, because it seemed to understand as I made preparations to try to free it. I kept watching really closely because, of course, a Western diamondback that large, if it were to bite me, it would be a life-changing event, to say the least, if I survived it. But I noticed that he was very calm, and it seemed as if he understood that I meant no harm, and moreover, it seemed somehow it understood that I was going to try to help it.
Is that a story that would be received more easily among your, Laguna Pueblo friends, family, than among your, European-descended friends and family? Or is everybody open to that?
Oh, no, I don't think so. I think even among Laguna Pueblo friends and family, there would be a...
Are you crazy, Leslie?
Right. They wouldn't want to kill the snake, whereas some people from outside the Pueblo might want to, a lot of Arizonans and Texans like to kill snakes. Yeah. But the Hopi Pueblo people who are related to us at Laguna, mm-hmm. They have a snake cult and the famous snake dance where they handle the rattlesnakes. And so I knew just from my knowledge of Hopi Pueblo and the snake dance that rattlesnakes and people really can establish some kind of communication. I just didn't know whether it could be done so quickly as I needed to do it that morning.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Leslie Marmon Silko about her new book of life and nature, The Turquoise Ledge, and talking about the Native American voice in American culture. Leslie Marmon Silko joins us today from Portland, Oregon. And Leslie, lots of callers for you. Let's go to one right away. Sam's calling from the highway in South Carolina. Hi, Sam. You're on the air.
Hi. How's it going?
Pretty well. What do you know?
I just wanted to say that I understand it completely. And I'm originally from Brooklyn, New York, from the city.
Okay.
Where there's not too much natural surroundings there, but... Growing up, I did get the love of animals from my mom. She would let me bring in stray dogs, cats, hurt birds, whatever it would be. And I actually have a similar story with a dog, helping a dog out. A big, mean dog barking, looking very angry, and his leg was actually stuck in a sewer. And I was actually scared of him at first. I got the feeling that he knew I was going to help this dog out. And I came, pulled his leg out. He didn't ever... once tried to bite me at all, and the dog wound up following me home, and we kept him for a good 8 years until he finally passed on. And
wow.
And when she says that sometimes she understands animals better than people, I feel the same way.
Sam, I appreciate your call. Leslie, can it work whether you're from Brooklyn or from the New Mexico reservation country?
Absolutely. The old folks taught us that all animals, domesticated animals, all little creatures, were put into this world or here in this world to help us, to be our friends. We're all part of the same original stardust that everything is created from.
Sam, I appreciate your call. We'll talk about stardust. Terry in Spokane, Washington. Terry, you're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
I very much relate to being outside. We live only about 20 blocks from downtown and near a small pond. Mm-hmm. We have a blue heron, we have osprey, we have cedar waxwings, we had a coyote in the park, we had a moose on our television programs here yesterday, news, walking around the city.
Okay.
So we have an awful lot of nature here, quail and everything. One day my husband was standing outside looking up at a raptor in a tree in the front yard and stood there and they looked at each other for a while and then the raptor swooped down right in his face. It wasn't aggressive. It was just kind of like he wanted a close-up look and then flew off. So I'm outside as much as I can, as early as I can, and as late as I can. I think it's critically important to get away from the virtual reality we're smothered in.
Oh, Terry, I'm glad for your call. I mean, Leslie, this is a big point of yours, the way in which, as you see it, our consumer society works kind of nonstop to cut us off from too much.
Yes, it does. Solitude is now a priceless, it's beyond price, and beginning to, it's more and more difficult to find solitude, just a little time wherever you are, just to have your own thoughts and own observations. I just wanted to say the raptor swooping down to look at someone's face, the bees also. I used to be a little nervous when bees would fly up near my face, but they just want to see you, and they learn to recognize. They learn to recognize people that are friendly toward them, and it's something. We're part of the natural world, we humans, and we need that reconnection every now and then, or I think we get sick. You know, I think either spiritually sick or physically sick. We really need solitude and connection with the wild things.
How do you hold the beauty or the wild and the ugly and terrible side by side in your life, in your mind? I mean, you're musing a lot on family history here. You've got essentially slavery in your family history. I mean, describe that for us, and then, you know, how do you fit it all together?
Well, the slavery that I refer to is the Indian slavery. And as I began working on this book, I researched, and I was horrified to realize that after the 13th Amendment was passed in 1865, which outlawed slavery in the United States, it was not applied to indigenous communities. It was not applied to Native Americans. And
Where were they enslaved? How? Where?
Well, they from the time the Spaniards went into the New Mexico Territory, the enslavement of Indian children was a weapon of war. They found that the Indian warriors were not afraid to die in battle, but if you threatened to take their children and sell their children into slavery, they were devastated.
How do you define slavery? Just so I know, Leslie, I mean, are you talking about just going off to an Indian school or actually, I don't know, working under as a slave?
This is before Indian schools, Tom. Mm-hmm. This is in the 1800s. In 1823, mm-hmm. the Spanish territorial governor of New Mexico sent out vindictive bans, and what they basically did was grab children, Indian children, and kidnap them and take them away from their families forever. This isn't the boarding school system. Mm-hmm. This is earlier. And the Catholic Church would baptize them as maids and servants. That's what they were noted on so there's records of the numbers of children that were enslaved. And more money could be made from capturing Indian children to mostly Indian girls, little girls. You could make more money out of 2 or 3 weeks of kidnapping Indian children than you could in a year of raising cattle or sheep in New Mexico. So in the early 1800s, it was a way of retaliating against the Navajo and Apache people. But it was also very lucrative, and many of the children were sent south and sold into wealthy families in Mexico.
So it's not all lovely Arizona sunrises we're talking about here. Let's get a call from Falling Waters, West Virginia. Brenda, you're on the air with Leslie Marmon-Silko.
Hello. It is so nice to hear somebody else that has great respect for the what I call Mother Earth, and in you being in the Indian community, understand exactly what that is.
Yes.
I'd like you to know that I practice that almost every day, and a good example of that is between myself and my neighbor. I don't use insecticides. If I find insects inside my house, no matter what it is, I capture them and put them back out into the wild. And in return, they more or less leave me alone, where my neighbor uses the sprays and kills them and all this, and she's constantly being bombarded by insects, bees, and the squirrels that want to eat everything and destroy everything in her yard.
So you think they actually want to gang up on her in response to her spray can, Brenda?
Absolutely. I mean, I try to give them respect, which I think they deserve more than what we give them. And in return, they respect where I live. You know, I give them their freedom, they give me my freedom.
Brenda, thanks for your call. Leslie, what do you say to that? We're going to have listeners who say, all right, get me the spray can, and others who say, yeah, maybe.
No, the caller is absolutely right. Ants, for example, when I was growing up, the old folks would never poison or kill or harm the ants. They believed the ants were messengers to the Mother Earth and the underworld. And so if the ants were coming around your doorstep, the people would take an old dried up piece of bread and crumble it up a distance away from the door, and then the ants would go away. They wouldn't be on the doorstep or coming in. And the people didn't like to kill flies. The old folks that raised me didn't like to kill flies. They would put a piece of white cotton on the screen door, and the flies, for some reason, are attracted to the bright white of the cotton. And so when you opened and closed the screen door, the flies wouldn't go inside the house. And it was because flies also are believed to be, in one of the old stories, green bottle fly carries an important message to the Earth Mother at a time when human beings are in a lot of trouble with the Mother Earth. And so to commemorate the help that fly gave to humans, the old folks would not harm a fly.
You take it maybe even further. At one point in the book, you're talking about creatures, nature, acting as a kind of go-between between living humans and the departed, the dead.
Yes, there's some kind of wonderful, I don't really completely understand it, but as I've gotten older, I can see it, some kind of wonderful dimension that joins the animal, that the animal, the wild things, the birds and animals are more open, and that spirits of certain humans, I wouldn't say all humans, but those who are close to us, for a little while after their passing, it seems that they can, I don't know if they join up with the spirit or the soul of the animal, but that they actually can come and visit. And you can tell by the behavior of the bird, let's say, that it behaves in a way that a bird ordinarily doesn't behave. And in that way, you can sometimes tell that a spirit of a beloved person who's just departed, they come back to show you that everything is good, everything is all right.
I love that idea. Who couldn't? But of course, we long for that kind of communication too. I mean, what do you apply to that to bring you to a point of believing that? Is it partly because you have Native American ancestors? You feel like maybe I can't prove it in a biology class, but I just know it in my bones. Do you suspend science? Do you care about science when it comes to that?
Well, some of the discoveries in particle physics have really gone way, some other scientists feel way out in left field. But actually, I don't think that it's, that we're all part of this continuum of energy, and there's, different ways of communicating. It isn't just Native American, it's human. It's just that the indigenous people, not just Native Americans, but indigenous mm-hmm. people on all continents, have spent more time. It's a matter of spending time observing, spending time living close. And you don't have to be Native American to discover that in your human consciousness. You just need opportunity, but sadly, that's what we don't have. Getting back to what mm-hmm. we were talking about earlier of solitude, and we're bombarded with devices and having to talk, be in touch and talk to humans, and you can't develop this innate sense that we all have. I believe it. You can't develop that unless, well, first of all, you have to want to, mm-hmm. and you have to realize that it exists. But you need the opportunity, and that's what's missing now, and that's a hard one to solve.
Kyle in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Kyle, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I'm a pro-migrant blogger and community organizer. I was born and raised in Guatemala of U.S. citizen parents, and spent my early life on the South Pacific coast with no electricity, no running water, and I greatly appreciate what Leslie has to say about connecting with nature. I know I certainly go to nature to center myself, especially back in Guatemala where I was from. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I wanted to say it's important that we don't idealize nature and withdraw from some of the ugliness that she's talking about in Arizona, which I've been fighting against, because I think there's also some ugliness in nature, too. And, you know, I think specifically of man-o-wars, these predatory birds that essentially feed and make other birds regurgitate their food, and that's how they live. And I don't know, there's just an ugliness in nature, too, that I think informs some of the ugliness in humanity, and it's important we don't withdraw from that, because there's a lot of work to be done.
That's very interesting. Leslie?
Well, I know that's always a danger that we can say, well, we just will simply completely leave the human world and we won't pay any attention to the injustices and the sufferings of human beings. And of course, we can't do that.
But Kyle is saying nature itself has real ugliness.
Well, it might not be pretty to make another bird regurgitate, but that's different than torturing and waterboarding somebody. I think there's, for me, quite a difference between what wild creatures have to do to live and what humans do, not because the humans need to do it for food or any other reason except out of a kind of meanness of heart. And I don't see meanness of heart in wild animals and birds and things. They do what they have to do, but they don't go out of their way to torture and to harm for, you know, ideological reasons.
How do you explain that or think about that then? Because, of course, humans are nature too.
Yes, and I think that the farther we have gotten from our more natural surroundings, the more it's intensified a kind of dysfunctional behavior. And of course, we know from keeping wild animals in zoos where the habitats are too small, all sorts of unusual and unnatural behavior can develop in wild creatures. And I think that we're similar. And because we have to rush around, because we have this all the bombardment of demands upon us, also just some of the conditions of, you know, polluted air and crowding, I think that these kinds of conditions have bring out the dysfunctional, ugly, hateful behavior in humans, and we can't get healthy again, and we won't be able to live peaceably with one another until we step back from the kind of post-industrial technological world that we've created. I really think we have to step back.
You may be right, but it's interesting. I mean, we're told from history that Native Americans, in a quite unspoiled environmental landscape, no small number of tribes lived in a more or less constant state of war.
Well, the Indian style of war was a little bit different than unmanned drones in Afghanistan.
Still, it tore your scalp off and killed you.
Well, actually, scalping was something that was started by
It killed by you. Let me just put it that way. It meant death, right? War.
No, usually it meant taking captives and ponies and things, stealing more than killing.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Leslie Marmon Silko about her new book of life and nature, The Turquoise Ledge, and about the Native American voice in American culture, what we hear, what we need to hear. Leslie, I'd love it if you'd read a little bit for us where we begin to touch the turquoise angle of what you're seeing and writing about here early morning in southern Arizona.
Okay. I'll start out. At 5 a.m., the sky over the Catalina Mountains is an ethereal mist of lavender pink. The humidity in the air above the peaks reflects the light of the sunrise blocked by the mountains. I hadn't walked in weeks, and all the lovely colors of the morning called me out. I took off my sunglasses and hooked them over my shirt in case I needed them later. The ant palace on the first hill was all closed up, as if the ants expected rain or more hot weather. At another ant palace, the entrance was open, and a few ants were standing nearby, as if they were about to call it a day as the sun rose higher. I see fewer shoe prints on the trail since the big heat descended. I found two turquoise rocks soon after I turned into the big arroyo. The startling bright blue turquoise was right where I'd walked many times before. Was it there before, but flipped over to hide its turquoise side? The flood last month rolled it over so the turquoise was visible. The rock is a gray limestone, the size of the tips of my fingers and thumb held together. The turquoise has orange-brown iron spots scattered over it like dust. The second turquoise rock was about the same size, but with a reddish-brown iron-bearing stone with turquoise that resembled lichens of bright green. I put the turquoise stones in my jeans pocket carefully so I don't lose them. I keep any broken glass or other trash I pick up in a separate pocket to protect the turquoise rocks.
Leslie Marmon Silka reading from her new memoir, The Turquoise Ledge. And here, Leslie, you're going beyond the living, breathing to the actual, you know, stuff of the up to rock, to turquoise. What's your relationship over time?
Well, I had been reading some speculations about extraterrestrial life and extraterrestrial intelligence, and the projects that we have of sending out radio waves and also trying to catch radio waves from other intelligent beings mm-hmm. across the galaxy. And one of the books speculated that that intelligent life might be organized very differently from ours. It may be very long-lived, and it may have been so evolved and so intelligent that it took a form that was more indestructible for interplanetary travel, like rock or rocks. And so I thought, you know, I mean, that's one of the theories that's posited. And so I thought, what if, in the rocks here, there's intelligent life, but we're the ones that aren't smart enough to figure out how to communicate, or, you know, or since we don't expect there to be old extraterrestrial life in the rock, if you don't expect it, how can you even you won't even look for it? So that's kind of where I got started, and then to begin to practice it, I started to pay more attention to rocks that seemed to be calling out to me or catching my eye. And so that's where I got started with it.
And does that flow from Laguna Pueblo culture, stories? If your great-grandmother heard that, or the aunties you grew up with, would they nod and say yes? Or would they say, Leslie, you've been watching too much Star Trek?
No, I think they would. I think they would agree. The old folks always said that all things, even inanimate things, have spirit and being. And of course, in other cultures, the Shinto religion, I think they had a ceremony for a chip, a microchip. I mean, it isn't just indigenous cultures that have this idea. And of course, the old Chinese have many stories about rocks,
jade,
that move
and all the
around.
Rest.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and they talk.
The mountains.
They actually, they actually talk to people.
I worked with an old wonderful guy from Lapland. He was a Sami people. You know, he worked all his life deep in the mines, and we were on a kind of earth-moving, shall I say, job, and he had this little leather bag of the most amazing pieces of the earth he'd ever found way down in the mines, and you can't help but look at them and not feel power. On the other hand, you always wonder, Am I just making this up, or am I feeling power? Sure, can feel powerful. Sherry in Malden, Massachusetts. Sherry, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, Ms. Silko. I can just tell from your voice, the peace in your voice is so beautiful to me. Thank you. I wanted to say that I'm from Kentucky, near the Appalachian Mountains, where the mountaintops are being removed. And
for coal.
Mm-hmm. Not everybody talks about what happens to the people and the land in that area. They talk about the, you know, the global warming, which the both of them are terrible. And to me, it is trying to control, not paying any attention, and the whole culture is being lost there, my culture. And I have a farm in Mount Sterling, and I almost sold it because I'm a writer living on a writer's wages, and I decided to keep it, and I'm making it into a retreat and nature preserve, an artist retreat and nature preserve, because we don't get solitude, as you say. And at the beginning of the summer, I came into my driveway, and there was an owl waiting for me, just watching me. He came twice. And so that, to me, was a message. And I dug a pond and waited for the springs to happen and the spirits of the spring. They came, and a friend of mine said, I said, well, what do I do? And she goes, well, you listen. You learn to listen. And so over the summer, the pond filled up, and the pond became this entire ecosystem with herons and bugs and tadpoles. So that's what I wanted to say, that I'm trying to keep this little piece of land as a spot where people can come, and they can come for free and stay as long as they want.
Good for you.
Thank you, Sherry. Leslie, what do you say? You're saying something similar. You want to stay in one place. You don't want to move around too much in the American way. You want to be there and just feel the place more and more deeply.
Yeah, I think that's it. I think that that all of this moving around is a relatively new thing, and that we human beings aren't adapted to it any better than when they move herds of caribou or elk out of their regular habitat. And so it really does my heart good to hear about people that are doing these things. To stay in one spot and to make a place where people can have solitude and be in touch with nature. And so I'm hopeful, because I believe it's within each human heart and with individuals that we can begin to turn turn human beings in a more benign direction.
Let's go to Susan in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Susan, you're on the air with Leslie Marmon Silko.
Hello. Hello to you both. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I concur with Leslie. I was born in Virginia but left as a child and spent 43 years in California. And I was always a very spiritual person, loved nature, wanted to be with nature, loved animals. And then 9 years ago, I came back to Virginia, where my tribe, my grandmother, was Rappahannock. And I find that if you watch nature, if you spend time with nature and observe, I believe you become a better person. And we are all interrelated. We are all interconnected. Our survival depends on them. Their survival depends on us.
Susan, I appreciate your call. It's very straightforward message, and we hear it. I appreciate it. Let's get one more. Wes in Boston. Wes, you're on the air with Leslie.
Ocio. That's hello in Cherokee. I'm also Saladi or Cherokee. And I just wanted to thank you for the book Ceremony, because I read that in college, and it helped me a lot as far as, because before that, I think I was kind of struggling with my identity as, am I white, am I native, and, you know, it kind of helped me in the process of becoming, a Native American who just had a good amount of European blood, rather than thinking of myself as biracial and confused.
Is it a more peaceful place to be, Wes?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I've over the years, I've really embraced my native traditions, and I found a religious community that practices the old Salagi ways, and so it really has helped. I also, have been alcohol free for 15 years.
Wes, I appreciate your call. Thank you so much, Leslie. We've got Wes read your. Perhaps most famous book, Ceremony. We've got lots of people here talking about the same thing. Here's Betsy saying, I was introduced to you in the American Literature course, University of Pittsburgh, followed you ever since. She says, Ceremony is the one novel she returns to every year. It's incredible. Sarah says, Ceremony is one of the most beautiful books I've read, assigned in an honors humanities class in college. Absolutely loved it. Sounds like it may have helped change Wes's life. But that was 1977, 78, and I wanted to ask you while we've got you, Leslie, in the years since then, that was a book that the story of a World War II veteran, shell-shocked, coming back from the Pacific, trying to find himself again, struggle with alcoholism, a shaman helps him come back and figure out life. But the Native American community itself has changed a lot in just these, 30, 40 years. Big casinos and big money now. Do you still see the Native American community as the repository of the kind of attitude toward the earth and life that you're celebrating in the Turquoise Ledge, Leslie, or not?
Well, I think the casinos are big and splashy, and it's big money, and there's big entertainment acts, and so it's easy, it's easy to have that overshadow the heart of the indigenous communities. But for the most part, the casinos, the casino life is something that's separate, and that in each little Indian community, there are very solid groups of people who follow the old ways, who follow the ceremonies, and I think it's just a you don't hear about them. This is all very private. It's all very quiet. It's done, if not in secret, but done in a very low key way. So there's no way that how could people know that that's going on? There's so much
hoopla.
So much attention is on the right hoopla with the casinos. So no, don't worry. We haven't all gone over to the casinos.
Okay. Annette in Woodstock, Virginia. Annette, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Leslie. I want to tell you, Leslie, I haven't read anything that you've written, but I feel so connected to you. I consider nature as my religion. I love the solitude. And I have a deep respect for the Native American culture. I find myself spending hours in the local Shenandoah Mountains here, just observing the simple things in nature. And I am going to be relocating in the spring back to Arizona. I lived there for 6 years, and that is where my soul is. And I love just the fact that it's such an amazing ecosystem, and just the beauty and the ability of the plants and animals to survive in such a harsh environment. But what I wanted to say, too, is that how important it is. I'm involved with a local nonprofit, and we teach environmental education. And we really need to reconnect children with nature. Children can identify 10 products by visual logo within a matter of seconds, but they can't identify 10 plants. And children who are in nature have a decreased incidence of ADD and depression. And environmentalism is really an endangered, environmentalists are endangered species. We have to get children connected so that they care about Mother Earth, and that they're going to support preserving natural places and policy that supports the environment. So I just want to tell you how much I feel that I can relate to what you're saying, and I just can't wait to go out and buy your books. And thank you.
Thanks, Annette. Thanks so much for your call.
Thank you.
Leslie, there's a thought here that you shared. The Turquoise Ledge is not linear. It sort of weaves back and forth in time and through your own life, lives of ancestors, lives of animals, life of the earth. I read you saying somewhere here that linear time itself, quoting you here, linear time itself is a fiction, which you find tedious and simple-minded. What do you mean?
Well, as best I can understand, what they've discovered at the subatomic level, and now they're discovering that those same thing, those discoveries may apply in more macro situations, but that past, present, and future are at that level. It becomes just present. Past and future don't really exist as we know. What exists is right now, this present, this present moment. And so how can I put this?
Well, you're willing to stretch then our sort of regular narrative of 1, 2, 3 linear.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. Well, calendars and clocks, we know this because in Arizona mm-hmm. we don't follow daylight savings time. Clocks and calendars are aids. They're not real. They're just something that we use. There are many different calendars. So that's why I call them fictions. They're whatever we say they are.
Leslie Marmon Silko, looking under the clocks and under the calendars. You say you have reason for optimism, Leslie. We just got a few seconds. Is it true?
Yes, it's true. There's many, many good people out there ready to connect with the natural world and with one another.
Leslie Marmon Silko's new book is The Turquoise Ledge. Leslie, thank you very much for your time and insights today.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.